Greetings and welcome to Edgy Ideas, the podcast that explores what it means to live the good life and create the good society in our disruptive age. My name is Simon Western, and I will be talking to invited guests about diverse topics, exploring social conscious and unconscious dynamics and desires. Edgy Ideas is proudly sponsored by the Eco Leadership Institute. We offer coach and leadership training courses, and we have a vibrant community of practice where international members join once a month for a webinar. Our focus is on co-creating the good society. To find out more, go to www.ecoleadershipinstitute.org, and to read my polemic blogs and essays, go to Simon Western at Substack. Thank you for listening. Welcome to this edition of Edgy Ideas Podcast. Today we have a very special guest. We're delighted to have Henry Mintzberg with us. Henry is a world-renowned writer and educator in the field of management and organizations. His current focus is on rebalancing society. Henry received his doctorate from MIT Sloan School of Management and made his professional home at McGill University, where he sits in the Cleghorn Chair of Management Studies. Henry authored 21 books. He has 21 honorary degrees and an officership in the Order of Canada. Henry also co-founded the International Masters in Practicing Management and Coaching Ourselves. These are novel initiatives for managers to learn together from their own experience. Henry, you're very welcome to Edgy Ideas. How are you today?
I'm fine, Simon. You know, the IMPM, the International Masters Program, started 25 years ago, and that's when you and I got to know each other, believe it or not. I mean, you believe it, obviously. And it's so nice to renew the acquaintance.
Yeah, very happy memories. That was my first introduction into the management field. I came from the psychotherapy and met Jonathan Gosling, and I was doing a PhD, and he introduced me to you, and it was very, very exciting years. So delighted to remember those.
Good. Nice to think about it.
So, Henry, you've written so much, and there's so much to talk about. But what I'd really like to look at today is what brought you into this field in the first place? What engaged you with the idea of studying management and organizations?
Well, I guess I was going to do the proper thing and go into business. I had an engineering degree in mechanical engineering, and I was going to go into business. But somehow I was suspicious of MBA programs. Those were Harvard phony kind of people, and not that they all are, but some are. And, so I was an engineer, although many engineers went to places like that. And so I decided to do a master's in industrial engineering and become a consultant. And ended up at MIT because it wasn't called industrial engineering, but it was a master of science. It wasn't called an MBA, although today it is. It kind of was an MBA degree, but with the new style, the Carnegie style, which had just started to take over business schools in the early 60s. And then I guess I enjoyed being in academia too much, and it sounded better than going back to a big company like Canadian National Railways, where I worked before. Mm-hmm. So I stayed and got a doctorate. Never should have happened because, I don't know, my grades weren't that good. And I don't know, I just kind of lucked out on various fronts and did okay until it came time to do the thesis, and then I became successful.
Yeah, that early thesis was turned into a book, wasn't it? And it really kind of shaped your early career. Do you want to say something about that?
Yeah, it's called The Nature of Managerial Work. Essentially, James Webb, who now has a telescope named after him, mm-hmm. or some kind of telescope system named after him, was running NASA and wanted to be studied. He thought he had a new style of management. And so he approached people at MIT, and I was the only one in the whole school who had any professed interest in management. Everybody else was in operations management or in marketing or finance or whatever, but I was the only one interested in management. So they Webb laid on a trip with his private jet through NASA and meeting Wernher von Braun and all that stuff. And they asked me to go along because I was the only one who might do a thesis like that. But I said no, and then couldn't find a thesis. And so said yes. By this time, Webb was embroiled in politics. So I studied five other chief executives. I did what set me off on my career in general. I went in with the obvious that managers plan, organize, coordinate, and control, which Henri Fayol, French industrialist, discover mining executive, described in 1916. That's what everybody thought. Managers plan, organize, coordinate, and control. So there I was, sitting in the offices of five chief executives in the United States, watching what they did for a week. And I kind of, where is planning and organizing and coordinating and controlling? You know, they're spending an awful lot of time with people outside their units, like maybe union representatives or government officials or customers or whatever it is. That's not planning or organizing or coordinating or controlling it. They kept getting interrupted a lot. Well, that's not the image of planning, organizing, etc. So what I was seeing was completely antithetical to how people thought management looked like, including managers who knew darn well what they did and that they were interrupted. But that's not the image that was professed to the world. It's not the way they thought about themselves, I guess. And so I basically took the obvious that was sitting right in front of my eyes, wrote it all down, and published it. And that's what I've been doing ever since.
It's so interesting because observation is quite a simple thing, and yet it seems that not many people do it, but you specialize in it, don't you? A really big part of your work, or part of the IMPM.
Yes. Well, I wrote an initial article called Structured Observations, a Method to Study Managerial Work, because basically I observed. I didn't send the earlier work, which didn't come to much of it, sent out questionnaires and asked people to keep timesheets and all that stuff. But you had to be in the office and see what's going on. And then you could pick up all little clues that people don't even think about, you know, that's going on in the place.
Yeah. I mean, it's so interesting. When I worked with you on the IMPM, I was there to think about the leadership exchange program. And this is where managers go and visit each other. And we ask them to observe each other and give each other feedback. And they all come away with quite profound experiences and say, this is one of the most important parts of the management degree. Just that observation and being observed and getting feedback. It's so important.
Oh, it's amazing. It's amazing what, you know, Yogi Berra was a famous American Yankee, New York Yankees baseball catcher who became a manager of the team. And he said all these weird things. But one of the most compelling was he said, you can observe a lot just by watching. He's the one who said, when you come to the fork in the road, take it. And it was deja vu all over again, and you know, all those things. But you can observe a lot just by watching. Well, it happens to be true.
The other thing about your work is I picked up your latest book on understanding organizations finally, and I was struck by the clarity of it. You have a real clear way of thinking and writing. And what do you think influences that? Where does that come from?
I'm not sure. A very dear friend helped me edit my doctoral thesis. Can't remember. I think it was the thesis itself. Might have been the book following the thesis by a couple of years, few years. And he's very harsh as a critic, and he would yell and scream at me about all the things I did. So did that teach me how to write? It certainly helped. I may have had a predisposition to, because I like to write in metaphors, for example, and I use a lot of colorful language and so on and so forth. So, but what also makes my writing clear is 10 drafts. In fact, I'm working on an article that I sent to my daughter as a first outline. And I said, don't be too horrified because this just looks hideous. But, you know, after 10 different outlines and 10 different written drafts, this will be coherent. So I rewrite and I rewrite and I rewrite and I rewrite. I read other people's work, some other people's work, and I'd say to myself, this is a first draft. It never should have been released.
Oh, that's really reassuring to me, because in my writing, I end up rewriting and rewriting and rewriting. And I sometimes think I'm slow, but you do have to do the work to get the clarity, don't you? And the succinctness.
Yeah. Even this book, which is based in part on the previous book. So I kind of knew where I was going, but there, at least for half of it, let's say. but the chapters were all written and rewritten, nevertheless. Mm-hmm. Many times, and some of them probably 5 times, and other books 10 times would be common.
What other influences on your career have stood out for you? What important things have stood out for you?
Probably the greatest influence on my career was an exchange with Herbert Simon in 1976, around 1976. Simon was the most prominent and significant management scholar ever, and kind of a hero of mine in a way, and somebody I had enormous respect for. I read a book about the two hemispheres in the human brain, and how the right hemisphere tends to be, if you like, more intuitive, more spatial. The left hemisphere, more analytic, more linear, more about vocabulary, and so on and so forth. And it struck me that that really described the difference between managerial work as had been depicted and managerial work as I had seen it practiced. And it seemed to me it was a lot more right hemispheric than left hemispheric. Mm-hmm. And so I wrote an article called Planning on the Left Side, Managing on the Right, sent it to the Harvard Business Review. They accepted it. They, sent back comments and so on and so forth. In the meantime, I thought I better send it to Simon, because I didn't know him really, but he was the most, not only the most prominent management guy of the era, but he had gone to the psychology department at Carnegie Institute of Technology as a cognitive psychologist. So he would know a lot more about brains and hemispheres and all this than I did. So I wrote to him and I said, what do you think of this? And he said, I don't believe any of it, or some such thing, something to that effect, and basically dismissed it. So I sat there. I was in France at the time, and just at the time I got a telegram at the time or something from Harvard saying, we need the article right away. And so I had the choice at that point of pulling it and basically saying, he knows something I don't, or including it and saying, no, despite his knowledge and everything else, he's wrong. Mm-hmm. And I decided on the latter and never looked back. I think he was biased. We had some interesting correspondence that's in my book called Mintzberg on Management, mm-hmm. with his permission, that describes our correspondence back and forth about this. And so I stood my ground and was able to go forward, despite my respect continuing to this day otherwise for Herbert Simon.
Another thing I've observed with your work, you're very mainstream. You sell a lot of books. You're very, very popular in management fields, and yet you critique management a lot. You're seen as an anti-establishment person in some ways, and yet you're selling a lot of books. That's a very interesting position. What do you make of that?
Well, they call me, or some people call me, a contrarian, with which I disagree completely. A contrarian is someone who takes an alternate position for its own sake. If everybody believes X, they take Y. That's not true at all of me. I couldn't sit in that office, having gone in with the words planning, organizing, coordinating, and controlling, sit in those 5 managerial offices, having gone in with that vocabulary, having seen what I did, and come out saying anything other than being contrary to that vocabulary. It simply was not correct. It simply was wrong. So I'm not a contrarian. I just see things differently. And when I do see things differently, I say it. And people say, oh, you're so courageous. I'm not courageous. I sit in my basement and write books. No, nobody's attacking me in my basement. Nobody's throwing bombs at me or waiting to get me because I insulted management or insulted some theory. So, I'm not particularly courageous. I just write in my basement, and I'm not certainly not a contrarian, and I don't think I'm especially creative. I think I take my clues from what I see.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, when there's a little test of creativity, like how many different uses can you come up with for a pen? I'm horrible at those things. You know, I don't play word games like Google,
yeah.
Bottle, or I hate those word games. I'm terrible at them. I wrote a blog called comparing real puzzles with so-called puzzles. A jigsaw puzzle is called a puzzle, but a jigsaw puzzle is not a puzzle by the dictionary definition. The dictionary definition is a puzzle is something difficult to do. Well, a jigsaw puzzle is not difficult to do. I mean, it may take a lot of time and be complicated. You've got to put all the pieces around, but it doesn't take genius or creativity to do that. So I'm kind of put off by puzzles, but I'm by those kind of puzzles, but I'm not put off by real puzzles, which is how in the world do you deal with societies that are completely out of balance? And then what I do is piece by piece, I find, you know, a jigsaw puzzle provides the pieces. You know, it's very interesting. You got the box, you got the picture you're supposed to make, you got the pieces you're supposed to put together. They all fit together perfectly in a certain way. Well, that's not very interesting. When I'm doing Rebalancing Society, nobody gave me a box. Nobody gave me a picture. I have no idea what the pieces will be. I know what some of the pieces will be. I don't know what other pieces will be. And when I find them or create them or whatever it is, they won't fit together that neatly. And I don't know what image I'm making anyway in the end, other than we need to rebalance society. So that's the way I work. It's a different way. I'm not sure I'd call it creative. I kind of made some notes because of our conversation and so on. But I'll tell you what I do think I am. I think I'm perceptive, or at least I'm willing to perceive things that other people don't want to perceive. So the little boy in the Hans Christian, did I mention that already today?
No. Tell us that story.
Yeah. So let me tell you who my only real hero is in life. It's the little boy in the Hans Christian Andersen story, because he had the courage to say that the king emperor was wearing no clothes. And everybody else was cheering this emperor, who they saw as wearing new clothes. Now, I look at a story like that and I say, what was going on? What was really going on? Well, number one, he wasn't courageous. He was just young. And so he kind of looked and said, I don't know what everybody's cheering about when this guy is walking down the street with no clothes. And he said it. He had the courage to see it. Well, that didn't take courage, but he had the courage to say it. But he was young, so he had no threats about saying it. Well, what about everybody else in the crowd? They didn't want to see it. They were afraid to see it. And so when I say I think I'm perceptive, I mean I am able to see things that are obvious, even though they're not obvious to other people, like these managers are not planning, organizing, coordinating and controlling, or at least those words don't help very much. So I think I'm perceptive. I think I have the capacity to synthesize, to take various thoughts and put them together. So it's not that any of the thoughts are so creative, but maybe the gestalt
is
more creative. And then what I do in life is I reframe.
Mm-hmm.
So I reframe managerial work. I reframe to how we describe managerial work. I've reframed strategy as learning, not planning, what I call emergent strategy, not deliberate strategy. I reframed, or with colleagues, reframed management education as social learning beyond autonomous teaching. So what I do is I put things together. That's what I do. I think a contrarian favors the opposite.
Mm.
I favor the obvious.
Interesting.
Yeah.
I mean, I see that as well. I mean, I've worked with a lot of critical theorist scholars, and they're very good at picking apart what's wrong with the organizations. But they don't do what you do, which is try and put it back together, which is kind of look at that reframing piece and looking at kind of how we could do it better. And then you go further and you actually develop a course or you develop coaching ourselves.
Well, that's a bit the story of the IMPM.
Yeah.
Because at one point, certainly my thesis and also my prior biases against the MBA program, but certainly my thesis indicated to me that the MBA program was not creating managers at all. It was destroying, in some ways, people's perception of management, because you don't learn management in a classroom. You learn management on the job. And so I wasn't particularly predisposed to MBA programs. So I was going around, I was being invited to a lot of universities, business schools, and giving what I called my flagellation lecture. I used to do it in INSEAD yearly after I had left, after visiting INSEAD for a few years, my flagellation lecture, saying that MBA programs develop the wrong people in the wrong ways with the wrong consequences, meaning with regard to teaching management.
Yeah.
With regard to teaching business functions like finance and marketing, sure, they do that well. But they give a distorted picture of management, because management is basically a picture of a triangle, okay? Art, science, craft, okay?
Uh-huh.
Art is novelty and vision and insight, and craft is experience and kind of human touch, and art and science is evidence and analysis. Okay. You can't teach art to anybody no matter what. So forget that. You can't teach craft because craft is experience based.
Yeah.
So you can't teach experience. And the case study is the worst way to teach experience, because it's not their experience. They don't know what the heck 10 pages really means. So MBA programs tend to teach the science or the analysis. And even the case study method is quite analytical about how you deal with cases, whereas whereas teaching theory and so on is very, can be very analytical and very scientific. So MBA programs lean toward the science or the analysis, which is what they can teach. Okay. And so people started to say to me, what are you doing about this? And I kept saying, I'm an academic. I'm not supposed to do anything about anything. I'm only supposed to criticize. But eventually we got humiliated enough and said, okay. And so a group of us got together, including your long-term friend, Jonathan Gosling, and we created the IMPM, which takes people who are managers and brings them into a classroom where they sit at round tables and spend half their time reflecting on their experience and sharing it with each other based on the theory and stuff we introduce. So we're not introducing theory to a bunch of know-nothings. We're introducing theory to a bunch of experienced managers. And if they can use it, we keep doing it.
Yeah, that's very, very interesting. What there's been quite a move in sort of organizational thinking. People talk a lot about flattened hierarchies and getting rid of structures and having more networked organizations, more kind of horizontal rather than vertical. What's your thinking about that, Henry?
Well, I wouldn't fly in an airplane that did that or go to a hotel that did that. But I would certainly use an advertising agency that does that, or watch a film done by a film company that that does that. In other words, this one best way concept that was introduced by Frederick Taylor over a century ago, We can't get past it. We have to constantly look for the magic bullet, the perfect answer. And in my new book, I talk a lot about project organizations. I call them project pioneers, and they have to be decentralized and all those good things, agile and all the popular words. But not my hospital, which I want to be a professional organization, not a project organization, although some of their research might be project. But I don't want to go into an operating room and the nurse bending down and saying, nothing to worry about. This is a really creative surgeon. And I want to say, I don't want a creative surgeon. Give me a surgeon who's done this 100 times. Yeah, it's true. If something goes wrong, I want the surgeon to be creative, but I don't want them experimenting on me. So we have this idea that every organization has to be decentralized and flattened and so on. Yeah. Yes, many do. Many do. Film companies, advertising agencies, many organizations have to be flat and agile and all those other good words, but many don't. I talk about 4 forms in the book, basically personal organization or personal enterprise, where the entrepreneur or the chief executive is kind of, you know, does everything. Program machine organization, classic bureaucracy like McDonald's, and a professional assembly and a project pioneer.
And do you want to say something about rebalancing society? Because that's a big part of your thinking at the moment, isn't it? I was very interested in how you reframe the third sector. You reframe what is sometimes called the not-for-profit sector. You broaden that, don't you? Into is it a plural sector, you call it?
Yeah, so I was in Prague in 1991, 2 years after the Velvet Revolution. The pundits were convinced that capitalism had triumphed. And, you know, one guy even wrote an idiotic book, an article about the end of history, that mankind had achieved perfection. And look at the perfection we've achieved today. Things didn't look bad in 1991, before 1991. It occurred to me right then and there that capitalism hadn't triumphed. Balance had triumphed, that the Eastern European countries were completely out of balance on the side of their public sectors. Government simply had too much control over markets and over what's usually called civil society, kind of community organizations, community aspects. And the healthy societies balanced those. And even the United States post-war had very high taxes. It had very generous welfare programs, and it had great economic growth. It was doing very well until Reagan started to mess with it and Thatcher started to mess with the British economy. They killed them. They were doing well until those idiots, and I mean that word quite clearly, those idiots came along and killed it. And so I got this idea, this bee in my bonnet, that there were 3 sectors in society, not 2. And then I went searching, because public, private, and civil society don't quite go together. Public, private, and community don't quite go together. Political, economic, and social, I was using that for a word, for a while. But eventually I went to a conference of people in this sector, and it's got all kinds of names, right? Not for profit and community and social and so on and so forth. And I was listening, I was supposed to give a talk, but I was listening to some of their comments before. And these were the experts, and they used about 6 different terms. They didn't have a label. They called themselves a nonprofit, I think, but they used about 6 different terms interchangeably. I said, you know, it's not, we need one term that describes the sector and goes along with public and private. And somebody said, how about pluralist or pluralized or something? And I said, wow, great idea. So I adopted public, private, plural, which works in 2 ways. One is the sector, the P's, but the other is the sector is the most eclectic of all. You know, business is business, it's very small, big and all that. Government is government. But in the plural sector, you've got all kinds of associations that are neither owned by investors nor owned by the state. So you've got NGOs, non-government organizations, and you've got co-ops, and you've got trusts, and all kinds of organizations, charities, and so on. McGill is a non-owned organization, not by the government nor by investors. So I like that. Recently, by the way, amusingly enough, somebody I work with says, Henry, we should really be calling it the people's sector. And I thought, maybe we should, you know, because plural, I'm writing a pamphlet sort of to popularize all these ideas. And plural is a bit of a, it's not an academic term, but it, so maybe it should be public, private, peoples.
Yeah. Do you get invited into the political sphere to share your ideas? Do you get invited by politicians to for your wisdom, to for your advice?
No.
No.
Do I get invited by political theorists? No. Rebalancing's, you know, basically in 1995, I published a book called Rebalancing, a small little book called Rebalancing Society. Looks like this.
Mm-hmm.
And convinced my publisher to allow me to offer it free as a PDF on my own website, which is still there. Amazing publisher, Barrett Kohler. And then it kind of, you know, you put something up the flagpole and everybody salutes. Well, I'm waiting for the salutes. Little by little, it's trickling around. You know, yeah. This is a trickle up because it's based on the ground in a way. It's a trickle up book. But the response is really interesting. In Japan, there's large interest. Three people flew from Tokyo to Montreal recently to spend an afternoon with me to talk about rebalancing society.
Yeah, yeah.
So one was a translator and a couple of others. And I've been interviewed by the editor-in-chief of Nikkei, which is the main finance publication, like the Wall Street Journal of Japan, but nobody from the Wall Street Journal in the States are particularly after me, or in Canada, the leading financial institutions are not particularly after me. So almost nothing from politicians. In fact, there's one person who I know, because I know her personally, she read the book, or I think she read the book. She's Deputy Prime Minister of Canada. I think she's probably keen, but much too busy, much too busy. But otherwise, I don't know any politicians who know that book. But people get in touch with me increasingly and in all kinds of strange ways from strange places and say, I want to help. I want to do something. Mm. Growing interest in France from several different parties. What can we do? We'd like to be part of this. So it's picking up.
Yeah.
People in the States, but not organizations in the States. One of the things the Japanese asked me when they were here is they said, you know, we're kind of an organization building up in Japan. How about the Canadian organization? I looked at them. What do you mean Canadian? There's no Canadian organization. There are people in Canada who are interested in this.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I've got people I work with around me. But I don't see my job as creating a movement in Canada. I'm just writing to create movements everywhere.
Yeah. Well, I think it's a very important idea. And it seems like a slow burn, but hopefully it will catch on. Henry, we're coming to the end of the time for the podcast. It's been really lovely talking to you. I ask guests at the end of the podcast a question about what their thoughts are on what it means to live a good life and create a good society.
Well, first of all, there are good societies, you know, if you feel the according to the Economist Democracy Index, a number of the most democratic countries in the world are small. Mm-hmm. All the Scandinavian countries, New Zealand, those kind of countries.
Yeah.
Plus, on that list are places like Costa Rica and so on and so forth. Mm-hmm. So there are wonderful places to live. Canada, I think, is one of them. Canada, not that small anymore, but Canada is a very sane, wonderful place to live. I try and spend as much time as we can in the country. We have a house about an hour from the city. Right now I'm in the city, and the decor is nil compared to up there. And we're on a lake, and you know, the neighbors are around but not too close, and it's okay. Wonderful. Yeah. So you know, we escape to nature.
Yeah, beautiful.
Good reason.
Henry, thank you so much for your time. Really privileged talking to you.
A pleasure, Simon. Nice to see you again.
Before we end this podcast, I'd like to say something about leadership and generosity. I moved from psychotherapy and family therapy into the field of management, studying leadership at Lancaster University, doing a PhD. Professor Jonathan Gosling invited me to do some research on the IMPM, Henry and Jonathan's International Masters in Practicing Management. As a novice in the management field, I suddenly found myself put in front of Henry Mintzberg and other managers presenting my research, and I ended up working on the program, leading their leadership exchange program. This is both an act of leadership from Jonathan, who trusted me when I was a complete novice, and it is also an act of generosity. So thank you, Jonathan, very much for that introduction. They were happy days. I really enjoyed working with Henry and Jonathan. The other act of generosity I must mention is that this is our 70th podcast. And for the first time in 70 podcasts, I forgot to press the record button on the first recording with Henry Mintzberg. Henry very kindly and generously agreed to do a retake a couple of weeks later. I think generosity is a really important part of the work we do in the field of organizations. So thank you, Henry. Thank you, Jonathan. It's been great working with you both. And thank you as an audience for listening. Goodbye.